Hello and welcome to Dyslexia Explored. I'm Darius Nomdaron, your host, and today we're going to talk about coaching athletes with dyslexia. This is a fascinating subject, and I'd like to introduce you to someone who wrote an article on this that caught my attention. It's an unusual subject. It needs to be talked about more. There's lots to learn from it, and I'd like to introduce you to a person who's got dyslexia themselves. She's got some with dyslexia, and her background is in social services. She's a director of a homeless initiative, has worked with refugees, and then shifted towards helping people with dyslexia. And you can guess why, probably because of her background with her own family and so on. And she'll tell us more about that. She's from the USA, Washington, Seattle. She's a licensed Davis facilitator, been helping people for the last 7 years with dyslexia. And she wrote a great article about coaching athletes with dyslexia. Let me introduce you to Sophia Goma. It's great to have you here.
Thank you so much, Darius. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, I read your article a while back and I thought, gosh, I've got to get you on the podcast and really talk this through about sports and dyslexia. And the reason why is often people with dyslexia are often very good at dynamic thinking, and that makes them good in sporting situations, especially team sports, reading the dynamic situation. They're maybe not good at reading and processing words automatically, but they can read and process a dynamic games pitch often very well. Exactly. Unfortunately, we can hit a roadblock when it comes to set plays and different things that are challenging for people with dyslexia, and it can be misinterpreted. And there's a whole range of things we can learn from this. And often we don't concentrate on this because we just say, oh, they're good at sports and that's it. But actually, sometimes they could be way better at the sports if a few of the roadblocks, if they were more conscious of the roadblocks, maybe their parents were more conscious of the roadblocks, and even some of the coaches were conscious of the roadblocks. So, Sophia, tell us a little bit about this. Tell us where your whole story began. What was life like before dyslexia? What was your wake-up call, especially in the world of sports and dyslexia? Tell us the story.
Thank you. Well, my story really started when my son was about 6 years old. He went to a Waldorf school, very happy, joyful, gregarious, loving boy. And in kindergarten, he just thrived. Things were great. As soon as he moved into first grade, he started just being very moody, called himself dumb, stupid, angry. And I asked, what is going on? And it really evolved around the writing work. He was frustrated that he couldn't make his letters look like other kids. And so, of course, I went in and I talked to the teacher. And luckily, I had someone who was a well-seasoned, wise teacher who said, you know, start reading up about dyslexia. I can't tell you that's what this is, but start doing some homework. And I'm so thankful to her because I did. And at first I would grab those books that made you feel like dyslexia was this horrible life sentence. And it was kind of depressing. And I thought, oh my gosh. And then I picked up the book, The Gift of Dyslexia by Ronald Davis. And you know, first chapter, I've got goosebumps and then I'm crying. I'm like, this is my son. This is my mom. And I didn't really say it at the time, but I thought, this is probably me. I can really relate to it. So a few months later, I had my son do a program, and that really, just a couple of days, and he was a different kid.
Can we give the Waldorf teacher a shout out? I'd love to hear her
name.
Kathleen Turner.
She's married since then. I think she goes by Smith as her last name now.
So thank you, Kathleen Turner, for being that wake-up call. And I used to be a Waldorf teacher, you know.
Oh, wow. No, I didn't know that.
I used to be a class teacher. I took class one to class four. And
fabulous.
I wasn't that experienced teacher like her. I would probably make the rookie mistakes of, oh, eventually they'll get it and so on. I've said that to many a parent. And now I kind of, you know, look back and say, okay, I am 50 now and I was 28 then. But, you know, eventually they'll get it is not good advice for someone with dyslexia. But let's go back to your so the wake up call this teacher, you did this program. What happened next?
I did the program and it was lovely. I mean, it helped him with his writing and his self-esteem. Not 100%, but it was very powerful in just a few days for him to change so much. So that was kind of the call of, I want to do this. I want to help others like this. He was able to pick up reading as quite quickly after that.
Was it a Davis program?
It was a Davis program. Okay. Yes, I apologize. Yeah. We were up in Alaska, so we had to fly down to Texas was a place where I could go to get a program at the time. And so I knew that this was something that was really special, that it helped him so quickly. The ability to, you know, focus at will. They give you self-regulation tools. So kind of a focusing tool, a breathing tool, a tool to regulate your energy and be aware of that. And that was just really powerful. And then they work with clay. So as a medium of learning, and that was exactly what he needed at the time. So while things became easier for him and better, there was still the, I'm not good at school, that kind of lived in him. And so I looked for, okay, what does he just enjoy doing? What else can we get him involved in to start feeling a little better about himself and what he could do? And that became sports. As early as second grade, he was trying out all kinds of sports. And that doesn't really go with the Waldorf methodology, pedagogy, you know, of how soon to get your son or child. Yeah. But it was perfect for him because he just became his self, you know, when he was on a court or, you know, playing football or basketball or, you know, any kind of sport, he just thrived. And I wasn't trained yet. But I could see that certain coaches worked well with him and others not as well. And it typically had to do with someone who was more hands-on. They were showing them all the moves that were out there, you know, their plays. They would walk through plays. And, you know, at second, third grade, you don't really have many plays, but it was just more of a visual process. And coaches who didn't require him to look at them in the eye. You find here, at least in the States, you have some coaches that think that the kids aren't listening if they're not looking at them in the eye. And my son is definitely a person who does better when they're not having that visual contact. So those were just some of the first things I noticed. You know, fast forward a couple years, I decided to become trained in the Davis methods. And then after that, while it's amazing work and I love it, the story really had to do with my son continuing in sports. And he has this natural athletic ability. And that's really, you know, when I look at things, that's his gift, is that ability to take a different perspective why he's on that, you know, on the pitch or on the court or wherever he's playing on the field, and be able to be very wise and intuitive about what another player is going to do, right? He can read other players well. And while he did that really great, it really depended on the coaching on how well he did in a game, what kind of coach it was. We ended up telling him, okay, we're spread too thin here. You need to pick one sport. And he chose basketball. And so that is where I really started paying more attention to just the different, his different teammates and how they interacted with coaches and how they did. I would say that the biggest eye-opener was seeing a coach just getting down really hard on his son, who was playing as well, and yelling, and me thinking a couple of times, that kid's dyslexic. And every time he gets yelled at, he just shuts down. And that's kind of when this article and thoughts started really spinning in my head of I don't think that there's any knowledge of dyslexia with this coach, right? This, he just has no idea. And then I realized, well, of course, that's just my life and that's what I live. So it's normal that other people don't have this, and tried to approach him and talk to him about it. And he was semi-open. He said, okay, I'll try some of your suggestions. Because I suggested, you know, why don't you, in practice, walk out some of these plays instead of just using your clipboard and moving things around? Because I knew that would help my son. He was a kid who, even like third, fourth grade, he had his, now I'm losing my vocabulary of what I need for this, but the playbook, or he'd make plays, he'd have his clipboard and try to move things around and learn plays and watch TV because he was so interested in it. And he knew it was confusing. And if he could figure that out, he would be better. So that's kind of where the story has come from, you know, of why I decided to write about this. That's
fantastic. So let's talk about the challenges of sport with dyslexia. You know, like, let's face it, many people will go, how does dyslexia affect sport? Because dyslexia is about reading, it's about writing, it's about maybe some processing, maybe if they're a bit more conscious of dyslexia, it's about working memory and so on. And then they go, well, what's that got to do with sport? Now, I know I've got a few answers myself, but what? How would you answer that? So what are some of the main challenges that people with dyslexia can face when it comes to sport? Could you kind of headline a few of them for us?
So I think one of the key things is just directions. Parents often know as well that giving a dyslexic child a lot of directions to follow, especially if they're verbal and there's a number of them, things can get missed, right?
Yes. Okay. So you don't just mean turn left, turn right. It's a sequence of directions, like in the sports. I want you to run up to that hoop. I want you to throw a ball in. I want you to go to the left and touch that and then go around this person and then come back here. Okay, go. And the child's like, oh no, I messed that up.
Yeah, absolutely. There's that, those sequential directions of what comes first and what comes next. But there's also the orientation that has of when you're a coach on the sideline giving a direction to a kid on the court, what does up mean, right? Or what does turn left? The kid can self, get themselves quite confused or disoriented, not knowing, well, is he talking about his left or my left or up? What does he mean by up?
Yes.
And
yes.
If that picture isn't clear, then there's confusion.
Yes.
So if they haven't had practices where they've been shown what their coach is talking about, it can be really confusing. They could second guess themselves when they're out there and not be able to follow those very well. So there's the sequential issue, and there's the issue of the orientation and what they're really talking about, having a clear picture of what's being asked of them. So there's those two. There's the maybe the tone of voice that's coming out. It could be intimidating or make them feel like they've done something wrong. And there's a lot of self-esteem issues that often are there with dyslexics. And so those are, I think, three of the main things. I mean, they all encompass a lot. But, you know, when you think about the self-esteem and the screaming, and there's the piece of the time pressure on them often, and requirements. If you don't do exactly what I say, you're off, right? So they want to perform in that small amount of time that they get to actually have playing time and not be on the bench. But there might be a little time delay of them getting into their groove and making sure that they're following everything and thinking about that. Another issue I have seen is that there's athletes and dyslexics in general that get a little bit of visual overload if they're just staring at someone when they're talking. For them, it's kind of, let's cut out some of this visual and think about what they're saying and try to build that picture in our mind to learn. My son is a perfect example of this. He has a difficult time to really look someone in the face and or in the eyes while he's being spoken to, especially like a history class. He said, looking at the teacher during a history class, I lose so much. Yeah. There's too much visual stimulation. I'm not building those pictures in my mind of what's being spoken about.
Fascinating. So I'm just looking for a book, actually. I'm looking away because there's a great book to do with sports in general called Bounce. Have you come across Bounce?
I haven't.
So have you heard of the 10,000 hours of intentional practice makes you world class at anything?
Yes, I have.
So Bounce was the book that introduced that, and it was written by Matthew Side. And he is a table tennis champion, British table tennis champion. And he was intrigued through his world champion games and so on. I think he was a close to being world champion, national champion, and played in the world championships. Don't know if he won any world championships, but he was intrigued by what made a world-class athlete. Now, the relevance to this and dyslexia is that they did a test on him, not to do with dyslexia, but because he was a table tennis player, they assumed that he had a fast reaction speed because you have to react so fast. And the British researchers who were doing some psychological research did some tests on everyone in the British team's reaction speed, and his reaction speed was significantly lower than everyone else's. And so they felt that there was some fault in their measurement system and process, and they actually abandoned the experiment. But they redid the experiment about 10 years later when they figured out that they hadn't made a mistake, and they realized that although he was one of the fastest players in the world, he had one of the slowest reaction speeds. They didn't understand it, but they realized that what he was doing was he was extrapolating what would happen from what happened before the person hit the ball. And he had played so much, he started to unconsciously pick up cues that made it look like his reaction speed was faster than it actually was. Now, that's a trait a lot of people with dyslexia have. They have dynamic reasoning in bucket loads. And so what they're doing is they're extrapolating data all the time. They're basically guessing, you know, and they get very good at guessing. We're constantly filling in gaps because we're making huge leaps between different pieces of information, wide-angled thinking, wide-angled perspective on things, and making those connections that it translates into the practical realm. And the reason why I mentioned that was, well, that's absolutely fascinating by itself.
It is.
And, you know, something that you can really harness with your child with dyslexia, but you can misread it and misunderstand what the gift is and think it's a reaction speed, but it's actually some form of creative imagination. They're imagining, creative logic. So there's a logic to what they're imagining. There's a logic to what they're making up, but it's normally a creative logic that a lot of athletes have, and he had in that situation. So tell us a little bit about solutions. What kind of solutions have you found? What sort of tips do you give to parents and coaches?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I like to get to. So I think solutions is just understanding. The first is that you have to understand that dyslexics think different, right? And so a lot of them their learning styles could be auditory or visual, but if you bring in many of those learning styles and realize that they're thinking more in pictures, you're going to be able to teach them better, right? If you can remember that and say back to them when there's confusion, well, what's kind of the picture going on in your mind? What do you think you got from this? So willingness to think about it, right? Knowing that there's a different way of thinking, and then kind of watching what you're doing. So for a coach, making sure that they set up their team, spending time at the setup, like make sure the student, their athletes know the vocabulary, right? Make sure that vocabulary is clear and, you know, that they know what, you know, a certain kind of kick is or a certain kind of shot is. Make sure that they're really aware of what upcourt is if you're on basketball or to know that vocabulary, spend time with it. That is just as important as practicing their shots because they have to be able to follow the coach. Have the coach walk them through things. There's some coaches I've seen that, you know, they're talkers. They're on the sideline or they've got that clipboard. Well, the symbols on a clipboard can be very confusing, right? And if the athlete isn't familiar with that, they're going to struggle. So if they take the time to set up their team and really lay the groundwork of vocabulary and just assume everyone is new to it each time, they're going to be more successful. And with that is to kind of give lenience for those kids who don't want to look at you in the eye, right? Understand that people are learning in different ways. And for some, looking at you can be more distracting, and to give the students the benefit of the doubt or the kids the benefit of the doubt. They're athletes that if they're there because they want to be there and they want to take what's there. So those are some keys. I think that just that alone shows the effort and can those differences can be bridged if they're thinking about that. And then for them to really think of, well, oh yeah, what does go left mean if I'm yelling it from the side and the student is there? Maybe we want different vocabulary, or maybe we want a visual of, you know, go to your other player or something like that. A name of a person, right? Instead of head to the right or left. So to think about those things. As a parent, it's the knowledge that coaches don't come with education around dyslexia and making sure that they have their kids buy in. Do you mind if I just have a quick word with your coach when you're starting a new league or starting a new team or something like that? And just let them know that you think and learn a little bit differently and you're a great athlete and your strengths, but this is how that they can help unite that team and build a stronger team. So,
Sophia, okay. That's really interesting about those tips about the vocabulary, walking through rather than talking through, having names for different directions. I've got a few thoughts, and this is a bit random, and you know, directions, and take this as you want as listeners. But one of the things that I did with my children to teach them how to tell the time and how to do directions was from a very young age, I used a military technique. There's a military technique where when you're giving someone directions, you say 1 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 12 o'clock, 9 o'clock, you know, and that gives you the rough orientation of where you should look. And then, you know, obviously you've got 1 click, 2 click, 3 click. I don't do that. But I did this from a really young age when we were in the car. We'd be in the car, okay? And I would just be in the car and I'd go, oh, there's a buzzard over there at 9 o'clock.
Oh, yeah.
And so we're in the car and the kid would go, I have no idea where 9 o'clock is, but I know what a buzzard looks like. It's that big bird over there. And so what happens is they orientate by the bird, buzzard, and then they associate 9 o'clock with that side of the car. And then I'm driving along and I go, oh, look, look at the big van at 1 o'clock, you know, and then there's a big van over there at 1 o'clock. And then and they look, and then there's something at 12 o'clock and there's something at 6 o'clock. And I don't even explain it to them because they just look yeah. for the van and, oh, I've got the van. And then maybe after 6 months, a year, 2 years, 3 years of doing this, there you can start saying to them, you know, 5 o'clock, bird of prey. And they're like, immediately at 5 o'clock, they look and they catch the bird of prey. Do you see what I mean?
I love that. I love that. Yes. And I am going to start using that because that is wonderful. That's perfect. That's exactly what we need.
And so you could use that as a coach, for example.
Yeah,
you know, you could
absolutely.
Be saying to, you know, Darius, 5 o'clock, watch your 5 o'clock, watch your 5 o'clock. And you're like, oh, my 5 o'clock. Yeah, I'm okay. You know, and that's what they use in the military. You know, like, I've got your 6, 1 o'clock, 3 o'clock. So instead of right and left, you imagine absolutely. You're standing on a clock. And the biggest irony of all of this is often we find it really hard to read a clock. With dyslexia,
yes,
you know, and
yes.
here I am giving you advice to imagine it as a clock. But the interesting thing is, if the clock's lying on the ground visually and
it
you're
works.
Standing in the center of it,
yeah.
and you make
you know
a
your
deal
orientation.
That 12 o'clock is always the goal, you know, then you always know your orientation, you know, like 12 o'clock, where's my 12 o'clock? There's my 12 o'clock. That's my goal, you know? And so you could even use that as language with your team, you know, 12 o'clock, go for the 12 o'clock, you know? And you're like, oh, the goal, the goal, the goal, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, you can start using that kind of language, like watch your 6, guard your 6, you know, go to the 3 and so on. You could develop a language in not just in the car, like I did with my, you know, three-year-old and 5-year-old kids. But the beauty of doing this in the car is that you're easy to orientate. There's always a front in the car, so you're not having to explain a lot of things. And it's just fun because, you know, you spot the red bus, you spot the bird of prey, whatever. And what happens is they actually do learn what 3 o'clock means. So when they see the clock on the wall, they go, oh, that's 3 o'clock. That's 6 o'clock. That's 9 o'clock. And they go, oh, I get what Dad's going on about now. You know?
Yeah. I love that. That is great. I think that's the perfect type of solution that should be developed for whatever team that is, or have something similar. So everyone has the same orientation, right? The
yes.
orientation isn't from the coach screaming from the sidelines. It's from you on the court. And
yes.
that's exactly what needs to happen. And I think I thought of one other thing while you were talking there is there's that kind of trust that the athlete knows what they're doing and less yelling from the sideline, I find is really helpful. Because when there's the coach is giving new directions from the sideline, it's hard to kind of develop that or synthesize that in their mind and refocus, especially if they're in a groove, right? And they're reading other players and they have that moment is the trust, that if a coach can give a little more trust and give their athletes just a little more time out there to follow their play, or if they know that this is one of their strengths is going out there and seeing what's happening and why can't I think of this word, kind of change it on the fly because they see what's happening and that they're
improvise.
Thank you. That is the word. If they're improvising will actually be more beneficial to the team as a whole.
Yes. I think one of the key things in all of this to bear in mind is you're talking about a young child, okay?
I am talking about a young child here.
To the middle age, middle years, teenage years, up to the teen years. But this affects every level of sport, every level of coaching. And as a child becomes more, let's face it, valuable to the team, in that they maybe become more proficient, they become more adept, and you start saying, you know, you're a really valuable part of this team, etc. And often people with dyslexia do find that space. They often become captains of teams because they bring to the team together. They have that social dynamic. They can see the interplay of relationships sometimes. It depends, obviously, on the personality and character. So, but the important thing, I think, is really to remember that you can lose yourself, a very valuable member of your team as a coach, if you don't do stuff like this. And some of the most motivated people in the world are people with dyslexia because they've got something to prove. Mm-hmm. And they really want to be good at something and confident at something, and they're naturally good at sports. But one of the interesting thing about sports that fits in with Bounce is that book, is they did an experiment with how to praise children in sports. And they did this fascinating experiment with 250 different primary age children in the UK. And these researchers did an experiment where they said, right, what difference does praise make to a person's performance? Now, obviously, we all know that if you praise someone, it's good for them, okay? But their question was, what kind of praise is better? And so they made two statements. They said, they tested two statements against each other. Have you heard this before? It's, you must be really good at this, compared to, you must have tried really hard at this, okay? Same amount of words, same intonation with everything. You must be really good at this. You must have tried really hard at this. And so what they did was they gave them maths and puzzle experiments and told them that regardless of the result, they said, you must be really good at this, or you must have tried really hard at this. Long story short, they did three different tests, and they gave the first three groups, in fact. The third group got no praise. They just got their results. So it was a proper blind test and so on, with a placebo, as it were, etc. Well, long story short was this. The people who were told, you must be really good at this, ended up performing 15% worse than they did at the beginning before they started being told that. And the people who were told, you must have tried really hard at this, performed 10% better than the control group. So actually, certain praise makes you perform worse. And they realized that they did the test really cleverly, because the first test was the same for both groups. The second test, they got to choose. Were given an impossible challenge in the maths. Very similar to the first one, but it was impossible. The first group that were told, you must be really good at this, quit really early. The second group who were told, you must have tried really hard at this, kept going to the bitter end and eventually gave up. Then the kicker is this. The third test they gave them, they said, you can choose which one you do. Do you want to do the hard one or the easy one? The people who were told they were really good at it chose the easy one. The people that were told, you must have tried really hard, chose the harder one and got better. And so when they tested them at the end, the people who were told they were really good at it tested 15% worse than when they started.
There's that intrinsic motivation of wanting to do better, right? Or to prove that you can do something. If you've already done it, you don't try as hard, right?
Well,
they're kind of saying?
Yes, it is kind of, but it's actually more fascinating than that. What happens, they noticed, was with the sports personality, was that when you're told you're really good at it, there's an unconscious sense of, how good am I? When does my good end? When does my talent finish? And so what they do is they protect themselves by staying in the zone where they have been told they're talented and good at it, and not risking moving into the realm of being bad at it. Those who are told, you must have tried really hard, are being told, your talent isn't relevant, your effort is. And so they actually push harder and start to realize actually it's not the talent that counts, it's the effort that does. And so what you find is that it's 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration, 1% talent and 99% effort that also works in life and also in sports. And so the way you praise someone is very interesting, it is very powerful. And this ties in with dyslexia for me because, sorry, I know you're the one who's talking about this, but I've got
this
a few ideas that have been holding up.
No, I love it.
So I've noticed that often as a teacher, you're often looking to see what attitude a student has. You've got an attitude radar, you know, that child really does want to learn. And so you go and you help them more because they want it. That child isn't that interested, is disengaged. So obviously they don't want it so much. So I won't give them so much feedback. They're not really buying in. Fine, I'll do the basics with them. And I'm not saying that we all do that consciously, but we do it unconsciously. And so we're looking for attitude. And what happens in sport is that the coaches are also looking for attitude. And so sometimes dyslexic traits can look like you've got a bad attitude. One, you talked about he's not looking, so he must be not engaged. And also, maybe he's not really that interested in being here. Maybe he just wants to be around with his buddies and so on, but he's not really interested in getting instruction or direction. And then, hey, he goes up on the pitch and he mucks it up and does some sort of joke to cover it up or whatever. And you realize you're not looking at it saying, oh, he's just covering up because he's got processing difficulties. He didn't get that. No, he doesn't care and he's making fun of it. And so the coach can misread that as a bad attitude. So he can misread it as he's got talent, but he's got a bad attitude. And a coach is looking for someone who has some attitude, some ability, but a lot of desire and passion and effort. And a person with dyslexia can often be massively misunderstood, even going up into professional level when these traits start showing up in much more extreme circumstances. Let's say you're playing American football. There's a very clear set play with a name and sequences and so on. And is it this one? Is it that one? And you kind of make up for it with some sort of bravado or I was just improvising or whatever, or, and they're just saying you're being a renegade quarterback or whatever, you know. All these dynamics can play in if you don't actually have enough self-realization as a player and also as a coach to start looking deeper than what you see on the surface.
You are so point on there. Yeah, absolutely. And I think just as someone who was observing these kids and out there playing, it was very much that those three things, you know, they're not looking, they're goofing off if they make a mistake out there, and coaches see that and they just discount them, right?
Yeah.
And they end up losing players. I've seen kids quit sports just because they're like, oh, I'm not good at this after all. And while I tried, the coach is just never going to give me a chance. And yeah, absolutely. So that no, or the willingness to learn from a coach, the willingness to observe and realize this can be really powerful for the team and for the student.
Now, one of the things that, yeah, the athlete. So you've got in this story, you've got the athlete, you've got the parent, and you've got the coach. Mm-hmm. And I'm passionate about not regarding myself as a victim. I'm not a victim of dyslexia. I've not got a disability.
Exactly.
I'm in a system that sometimes disables me. So I'm disabled, if you think of it in a social disability sense, in that the system and the processes around about me can put blocks in me being able to do some things. And so, but I'm not a victim. And so what you can also do in this scenario, I believe, is as a player, as an athlete, you can also take on responsibility for some of these things too. So you might not have a coach that you know, speaks to you the right way. You might not have a parent that understands you even, but you can start doing some self-advocacy, as it were, and self-awareness, and have some techniques to deal with this, you know? Like, I wonder what sort of things can the actual athletes do to take responsibility for, you know, making things work even better for them, even if their coach isn't fully aware of dyslexia and its implications.
Yeah, I think the first thing is get to know your sport, right? Get to know that vocabulary, get to understand that. Mm. My son watched a lot of YouTube videos on, you know, how to play this sport and to try to understand it better that way. So doing the learning and making sure that they're going in as knowledgeable as they can.
Yeah.
I think that's a good part. I think the mental kind of training in a way is good as well. And what I mean by that is being able to self-regulate and be able to understand your reactions to things and try to make a change there. Because if you're really motivated, you can do that. And the one thing I always go back to in my life, and just for me in everything, is my Davis tools, actually, those self-regulation tools. Is I got to get myself focused first, because I'm not going to learn when I'm confused and stressed out. I've got to be in that focus place, and finding your focus. What is it that's going to work for you? Some people call it grounding, or, you know, just get your orientation, be aligned for the task that's in front of you. In the Davis program, you have a self-regulation tool for focus that you imagine with your mind's eye a certain place. And that's great if you're reading, but if you're an athlete and depending on what sports you're doing, your orientation might be in a different place. So I'm always telling my students that I have, you know, you've got to find that focus for you in what you're doing, right? Because there's a certain type of focus as an artist, right, that we would want, but it's going to be a very different focus than if you're reading, because that creative genius in everyone, that flows, I think, from someplace else. So I think as the athlete, what they can do is learn as much as they can about that sport. Make sure that they have the vocabulary, find their focus. What is their focus? How do they get into that zone? And how do you kind of release stress when something isn't going right? So you're not the one who, you know, acts goofy and the coach discounts you because you messed up a play, you know, or react poorly. So those are the main things I can think of.
Yes. Yes. Fascinating. I love that focus. And I was thinking, if I was an athlete, I would maybe recommend that the child or the athlete explains to the coach sometimes what they're doing and why they're doing it. So like you could go to the coach and go, hey, coach, I just wanted to say, you know I wasn't looking at you when you were giving instructions there. And what I was doing was I was imagining the pitch and what you were saying in the pitch instead of looking at the eyes. Is that okay? And the coach goes, oh, wow. Extra points of attitude. One, for coming up to me and being self-aware and taking the hit, but not blowing up at me. And double points for, wow, you're visualizing the pitch and so on. That's brilliant. And then, you
Thank
know.
Thank you. Yeah, absolutely.
Another example of that might be, and drip feeding it, you know, the child drip feed it. You know, I find it really helpful when I see it on the pitch. And you might, maybe the coach says something and then you say, coach, you know, and because you've been visualizing it and the coach is okay with you looking away and looking at the pitch, you might actually be on the side of the pitch. But when the coach is explaining it, you might be looking at the goal and thinking, I'm going from this, I'm going to there, right? You're visualizing it. And then the coach says, any questions? You go, yeah, coach, you know, is that at the 25-yard line or the 35-yard line? And the coach goes, good point, Darius. I forgot to mention that. And because you're visualizing it, you're saying it's definitely the 25-yard line. Oh, is that the one with the two lines on it or the three lines or the flag on it or whatever, you know? And so you've got a visual cue because you won't remember 25. You're like, yeah, it's the one with the red flag on it. Okay, so, and what happens is, You actually end up becoming a leader because you're starting to articulate and own and internalize it by having to visualize it. And often a lot of the other players are following a sequence. They're not following the principles. And if you've got dyslexia, what you're often doing is you don't get sequences. You don't remember processes, but you do remember fundamental principles. And so it's like scientific principles. You might not remember the formula, but you remember the principles, and you actually end up recreating the formula. And if you're Einstein, recreating it, finding something that doesn't quite make sense and making a better one. But that's what's happening in a flash with a person with dyslexia often. And so that's why this person with dyslexia often asks why so much. And it gets annoying sometimes. I'm dyslexic, you're dyslexic, yeah. You'll understand that. So what's happening is this person is working according to first principles rather than secondary plays or processes. Now, plays and processes are important, but if they understand the principles, then it becomes even more, because they can then properly improvise according to the principles of the play. So they might say, oh, when I get to the 25-yard line, the red flag, does that mean that sometimes I go this way and sometimes I go that way? And if it's like this, I go like this. And the coach goes, yes, exactly that. You can change it around there because that. But as long as you're following this principle, you make sure you keep the ball as long as you can, et cetera, or as short, or whatever is the underlying principle. Do you agree?
Absolutely, I agree. Those are perfect examples. And I, not being an athlete myself, I hadn't thought of it that way, right? But you are so true, because that why is so important. That's how we operate as dyslexics, is knowing that why clarifies that picture for us, and we're able to hold that information and create and use it more. It reminds me of a lot of the clay work that we do in the Davis programs. Is if we really want to make something, remember something, we make it in clay. I remember for me, I'm trying to understand basketball for my son better. I couldn't remember the names of the positions and what did what. You know, they're talking 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 positions. And sometimes they say shooting guard or power forward. And I just couldn't keep it. So I created it all in clay. And by creating it, it was the same as building the picture, but in my mind, it was even more powerful for me. And it was there. And from there, I can move forward and work with it. So asking that why and being able to have that conversation with the coach is so powerful. You're educating the coach. You don't have to say, I'm dyslexic. You're not kind of using that as a, you know, a crutch. You're educating them that you need to look and imagine in this way and create in this way. And that's how you're going to be a valuable player. So I love that you brought that up. Thank you.
Yeah, there's a lot more we can talk about in terms of sports and dyslexia and, you know. Oh, and by the way, if you want to know more about if you are dyslexic, we've created a dyslexia screener called the Dyslexia Quiz. It's on the App Store. It's free. And it's the best screener you pretty much get, I think. It's top of the App Store. 5-star, 4.7-star reviews, highest reviews. Highest amount of comments, recommendations, and reviews for a dyslexia app, a dyslexia screener app on the App Store. So go check that out, and it will show you the 50 traits of dyslexia that you might not expect, and many of them relate to sports in an unexpected way. I'll leave that to you. There's many, many traits in there, and we've covered quite a few of them. Sophia, this has been a fascinating conversation. Where do people get in touch with you if they want to know more about what you do? Tell us a little bit about what you do and how people can get in touch with you. I don't know much about Davis, to be honest. Why don't you tell people who are listening about it and how they can find out more from you?
Sure. The Davis programs have been around now for about 30 years, so a long time, but they can reach me directly at www.learningtoolsforlife.com. And also just dyslexia.com. That's the Davis website where you can find providers all over the world for the Davis programs. The Davis programs are kind of intensive because we do 5 consecutive days. It's 6 hours a day. But you start off with learning self-regulation tools, the ones I talked about, the focus, breathing, energy that you have. And then from there, we look at symbols and make sure that there's no kind of triggers for any symbols out there. All language is made up of these symbols. We do that in clay. It's creative method. It's really engaging for most students. After that, we look at like reading exercises, but then move into making sure that there's pictures and meaning behind words that trigger us as dyslexics, those small words and the just, by, which. So we have pictures that allow us to think and process with those better and easier. These trigger words, there's 217, I believe, maybe it's 219, that we work on in clay. So we build pictures in those. So there's 30 hours with the facilitator. And then after that, it's working through those words on your own. And they learn everything during that program. There's some follow-up that's done as well, if wanted or needed. So programs for dyslexia, dyscalculia, and some attention programs that the Davis methods do.
Just for clarity, I've mentioned this in podcast 92. I'm just looking at the podcast here. The trigger words is not necessarily what we mean trigger, as in trigger anxiety and trouble and things like that. You're using a bit of jargon that's specific to Davis, aren't you? Stephen Martin talks a bit more about this he's the host of Truth About Dyslexia in episode 92, if you want to know more about it. But maybe you could explain what you mean by trigger briefly,
Sophia.
Yeah,
so if you think of being a picture thinker and you're learning how to read, and if you come across a word like just, and you don't have a picture for that, it can cause confusion. So you lose your focus, you can't remember what you've read before, or you start stumbling on the word. So that word has triggered you to lose your focus. We call it disorientation.
Oh, okay.
Into a state of disorientation. And that will make continuing reading more difficult, or, you know, just remembering what you read. I think for many people who are just maybe slightly dyslexic, they learn how to read okay, but that comprehension and remembering what they read is really difficult. And we see that as the reason behind that is those trigger words, these words that don't have pictures. So in the Davis program, if you make that trigger word in clay and make a model, you have the meaning behind the word, a visual picture for it. And then suddenly that just the problem that you had with it, of it triggering your disorientation, goes away and you can stay focused and read the words with no problem.
Got you. That's a great explanation. Yeah. Thank you. So I interrupted you.
Yeah, I think I was just quickly talking about the program. So they involve, reading exercises, working on these trigger words in clay, learning punctuation, things like that. I think what I personally do that I put a lot of emphasis on is kind of self-esteem and understanding that this is a way of thinking. It doesn't have to be a disability. Just kind of, as you said earlier, it's our society kind of puts these labels on you, and you can make that into something that's disabling, or you can empower yourself. And so I work with my students to always talk about, well, maybe spelling is never going to be your thing, right? Maybe writing is not going to be something that you love, but there's amazing writers out there. I mean, look at Agatha Christie, was dyslexic, and she's written more mystery novels than I think anyone else has. So it doesn't need to stop you from doing anything. That you can can do things and you have passions and your strengths might be in something different. For my son, maybe athletes. For others, it might be building. And when I have a 6 or 7 year old, maybe it's, oh, look at how cool you've built that. Or look at you playing this game, this strategic game, like I've never seen someone else. So we do things during the program that I get to understand that student more and help pull out their gifts and help kind of boost their self-esteem. Because most of the time when I have a student come to me, they already have a much lower self-esteem because of their struggles in school.
So. Well, thank you very much, Sophia. And it's been great to have you on the show. We will put all of the links relevant to you. How can they contact you?
Email or website. The email is just info@learningtoolsforlife.com. Website, again, learningtoolsforlife.com. Either way is great.
Fantastic, Sophia. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a great conversation.
That's a great story. Thank you. So I'll see you later.
Okay. Bye-bye.